In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these are the years we refer to as the golden age of radio.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word.
Don't touch that dial. Listen to...
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by Farmers and Mechanics Savings, the century-old bank with seven convenient offices in Middletown, Cromwell, Colchester, and Montville. You'll meet tonight's guest in a moment. Right now, the time is 11:30 at night, and the 24-hour tellers of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank can serve you even at this time of night. Get a for money card by opening a checking account or statement savings account, and you can withdraw up to $100 at any hour of the day or night at Cromwell Square, Main Street, and College Street, Middletown, and at the Colchester and Montville offices. It could happen on Friday night. You could suddenly decide to take off Saturday and Sunday to the mountains, the shore, the Cape, New York, or Boston. Aha! You find you're short of bread. So, with such sophistication provided by Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank, you can get $100 in a few minutes at the 24-hour teller. More and more depositors are carrying the great For Money card. A statement savings account tells you every month the total of savings, including the latest interest credited. It's the age of the computer, and Farmers and Mechanics is right up there with the latest modern features. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender.
And now, the golden age of radio with host Dick Bertel.
Good evening. And with me once again is the man with 2,000 hours of old-time radio memories on tape, Ed Corcoran. Ed, how are you tonight?
Very good, Dick. It's nice to be here again with you.
Well, our guest tonight is the author of the best-selling book, None of Your Business, or My Life with J. Walter Thompson, Confessions of a Renegade Radio Writer. I'm going to read from the dust cover of the book, first of all. With many of our young people challenging each other with trivia of the 1930s and their parents indulging in nostalgic memories of the same period, this book could well be the vehicle to bridge the generation gap. It is the rollicking, behind-the-scenes recollections of an advertising agency writer who not only witnessed the birth of radio and television, but helped deliver both. Ed, who is our guest tonight?
Well, our guest is Carol Carroll.
The midwife.
He's a best-selling author and maybe one of the funniest men we've ever had on the show, Dick.
Well, I'm looking forward to our conversation tonight, Carol. And
thank you.
We're going to be able to go back to the very earliest days of radio. You started off as a young man when radio was starting off, I guess. I guess you didn't know any more about radio at first than anybody else did.
It was the greatest learn-while-you-earn business that was ever invented because nobody knew anything about it.
What was your background?
High school dropout. Mm-hmm. We lived in Chicago, and I had some relatives in New York, and I came east one summer to spend the summer on the Jersey coast and got a part-time job in an advertising agency and never went back to finish high school. And that gave me some advertising background, and then I was a vaudeville buff, writing for vaudeville as well as attending it. And when radio came along, I was apparently uniquely suited for the job that advertising agencies had to give, which was a combination of somebody who knew a little bit about the art of selling via advertising and a lot about joke writing and jokes. And as a result of this, I got a job with the J. Walter Thompson Company.
As a matter of fact, you earned a lot of money for material that never went on the air at first.
Well, this was one of the things that made me take the job. I did three different jobs for them in rapid succession, getting, at that time, an unheard-of amount of money for anybody, much less me. $250 a week was pretty good pay for a kid my age then. Not a syllable of it ever went on, but I always got a check. So when Thompson called up and said, would you like to come and work steady for us, I figured I wouldn't have very much to do except pick up the check. And then I went to work for Burns and Allen.
Now, that's a chapter that we certainly want to explore, and we can hear Burns and Allen a little later in one of your excerpts, Ed. But first of all, perhaps we should establish how you, Carol, and Burns and Allen got together.
Well, that was done by a representative of the Thompson Company named Stanley Holt, who was the rep, as the agencies call him, on the General Cigar account. Thompson had hired Burns and Allen and Guy Lombardo to do a half-hour program to sell Robert Burns Panatellas. It was just an accident that they got Burns and Allen. It sounds as if it was planned that way, but it wasn't. And they needed somebody, as they had on every show, to sort of act as the agency representative while the jokes were being written, to see that somehow nobody, the client would not be offended, and that the jokes would be appropriate to the subject, and this is how the agencies got into the planning business. And he took me up to meet George Burns, whom I shall now from now on call Nat, because that's what I call him. And he said, Nat, I want you to meet Carol. Carol, he's going to work with you on the program. And I said, I haven't seen you since a show at the Riverside that was starring Fink's Mules. And this immediately put us together, because anybody who knew Fink's Mules was a friend of his.
I hate to ask what Fink's Mules,
Fink's Mules was a big animal act, trained animals. And as soon as he knew that I knew the vaudeville business, we became very, very close friends, and we worked very closely for 2.5 years.
Well, we were talking before we went on the air about the character. Goodman Ace, for example, when we talked about him, Jane, the air personality, was the same as the personality in real life.
That's true.
But how about in case of Gracie Allen? Was she really the same person as she was on the air?
No, Gracie was just a nice little lady who happened to have a funny voice. She had stumbled into show business because she was in part of a show business family, and Nat met her when she was doing a jig in an Irish act in San Francisco. And they got together because he liked her and decided that he could use a lady partner, because he tried every other kind of a partner, including a pair of roller skates. He gave her a routine in which she was to ask the questions and he had the funny answers. And as soon as she said, George, which nobody can imitate, there's nobody really capable of imitating her, the audience broke up, and Nat knew immediately that he was not going to be the comedian in that act, and he switched it around from then on, devoted his very, very great talent to giving this woman the kind of funny things that she could say effectively, and she frequently didn't know what they meant. Well, she said, a terrible thing happened the other night. My sister looked down, woke up in the middle of the night, looked down, her legs were all black. She gave out a scream, and George says, what did you do? She said, we all ran into a room. He says, well, did you get a doctor? She said, no, my mother just took off her stockings, and we all went back to bed, which is Gracie. Yeah.
Our guest tonight is the author of None of Your Business, or My Life with J. Walter Thompson, The Confessions of a Renegade Radio Writer. That writer is Carol Carroll. And, Carol, we're about to hear one of the excerpts from the early George Burns and Gracie Allen series, going back to about, 1932 or so. George Burns and Gracie Allen.
Well, Gracie, say hello to everybody.
Hello, everybody. What do I do now?
Well, just make something up, you know.
Oh, all right. I'll make up a riddle. I'll give you 3 chances, and if you can't guess it, you win.
If I can't guess it, I win? Well, what happens if I guess it?
Well, then it's a tie.
It's a tie?
Now, what's the difference?
Just a minute, Gracie. This one is on me. A fellow was in a restaurant. He ordered spinach, mashed potatoes, and cheesecake. How did I know that he was a soldier?
Is that the one where the fella had on a uniform? Yeah, that's very good, Judge. Tell us.
What I'd like to know is, how do I allow myself to get mixed up into these things?
Oh, that's very funny. Now, I'll make one up. Not only can I make up riddles, Judge, I can also tell you what you're thinking about. I'm a mind reader.
Listen, Gracie, is there anything that phases you?
I don't think so.
No.
All right, now, think of something.
Well, all right, I'm thinking.
Is it green?
Is what green?
Does it hang from the ceiling and whistle?
Does what hang from the ceiling and whistle?
Does it run along the floor and sing?
Listen.
Does it climb up buildings and swim?
Just a minute. I thought you said that you could read my mind.
Well, George, how can I read your mind if you keep on asking me all those silly questions?
I'm asking you. Listen, let's talk about something else. Well, Gracie, I'm sorry to hear about your missing brother.
Oh, that's too bad, George, because my brother's missing, too.
The only difference between you and me is that I have the power of mind over matter, and you have no mind, and it doesn't seem to matter.
Oh, I bet you tell that to all the girls.
Never mind. I still would like to know, how is your brother?
My brother? Oh, well, I think they ought to open up all the prisons. It would help prosperity.
Wait a minute. That's the wrong answer.
No, that's the right answer, but you asked the wrong question.
George Burns and Gracie Allen, 1932. Delightful.
He always asked the wrong question.
Okay. Well, one of the really great shows in that same era was the Shell Chateau, in which you played a great role. Could you tell us a little about that?
Well, this was another show that was created by the J. Walter Thompson Company. And we did it because Al had made such a big hit on the first Kraft Music Hall as a guest with Paul Whiteman. And at that time, when we booked Al, John Reber, who was then the guru of all radio and one of the great men of that era as a showman, wanted to know what to do with Al as a guest. And I said, well, the only thing you can do with him, if you really want to go off in glory, is to do what happens at the Winter Garden at the end of any one of his shows, when about halfway through the second act, along about 10:30, he'd simply walk down on the stage and loosen his tie and wave everybody in the cast around him and say to the audience, you ain't heard nothing yet, folks. What do you want to hear? And sing until he got tired of singing. So John said, well, what we'll do, we'll give him 15 minutes at the end of the show to do that. I said, it takes him 15 minutes to loosen his tie. You've got to do better than that. So he was going, and it got down to the time when it was quite clear that either we were going off in the middle of a second chorus or something had to be done. And Reber did something that has never been done before or since. He called up Deke Aylesworth, who was then president of NBC, and bought another 15 minutes, which was possible then because we were going on from 10 to 11. And from 11 on, we're all band remotes from obscure places like Kansas City. And it didn't make any difference. They were all sustainings anyway. And from this big success that Jolie had on this Kraft show, it was decided that we better buy him immediately for somebody else before somebody else bought him. So we decided to do what was given the code name of Five Acts and Jolson, and the problem was what to call it. Well, it was a fad then to have your show come from a mythical place like Captain Andy's Showboat or the Kraft Music Hall. Then it suddenly dawned on everybody that what the client wanted was to have the name Shell in the title. So we couldn't have Shell Saloon or anything like that. It didn't sound quite right. And finally we wound up with this classy name Shell Chateau, which Jolson habitually mispronounced, much to the astonishment of everybody. And the first time I took the script up to him in the Sherry Netherlands, he was in the had a suite in the tower there. I came in with a script, which I had written. He hadn't seen it. And he said, hello, kid, sit down. And he motioned me to a sofa, and he took the script and sat down at his desk, called up room service and ordered dinner, and then went on reading, and the dinner came up, and he ate it while I watched him, and kept making little notes in the margin of the script. And if you've ever sat there hungry watching Jolson eat, it was like a scene in the Tom Brown picture, you know. I was dying, and he was having a wonderful time. And making these notes that were, I was consumed with curiosity as to what was going on there. And he finally finished, still writing, got up, went over the mantelpiece, got himself a piece of chocolate out of a box, closed the box, came over and handed the script to me. He says, okay, kid, see you tomorrow at rehearsal. And I couldn't wait to see what he'd written. And when I finally got in the elevator and there was nobody there, I opened it up, and in the margin he had written, make better. But there was no indication of what this make better referred to. Mm-hmm. So the next morning I went to my boss, and he said, you see Jolly last night? I said, yes. He said, how was it? I said, well, here's the script, and here's what he wrote. And John read through it, so make better. He said, did you make better? I said, I must have, because I read it over this morning, and it read better than it read last night. And that's the way it went on the air, just exactly without the make betters. And the next week, at the same time, I went to see him. But this time I stopped at a bakery and bought 3 salt sticks to take along, and I ate them while he had his dinner. And he never noticed. He's a nice man.
And we have an excerpt from Shell Chateau.
Yes, Dick, very fortunately, there are some of these that have survived. These are probably the oldest shows in my collection, going back to the early 1930s.
Pity Jolson didn't survive because nobody sings like he did.
No.
And if you think every singer today has a little piece of Al in them,
all right, here it is. Al Jolson and Shell Chateau.
The makers of Super Shell Gasoline invite you to Shell Chateau, where your host is the world's outstanding entertainer, Al Jolson. with an all-star bill of famous guest stars. We switch you now to Shell Chateau, where you'll be greeted by Al Jolson.
Good evening, friend. Here's where your worry ends. Where everyone has been. Good evening, friend. Your name somehow I can't recall right now, but know you all I vow. Good evening, friend. Here's Herr Flamm, und sein Madame, Monsieur Berry, und Char Cherry, come on, pal, leave away, 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 away. I know you all I do. Good evening, friend. Pull up a chair and turn the light down low. You're at our cell to go. Good evening, friend. We're on the air just once a week, you know. This week a brand new show for you, my friend. The music starts, the curtain parts, an hour of fun for everyone. Although it's true that I cannot see you, I almost feel I do. Good evening, friends. Thank you, folks, thank you. And once again, I welcome you to Shell Chateau, where each Saturday night we offer you the brightest stars in the entertainment world. Listen, and I'll tell you who we have here tonight. Victor Young and his music. And I want you folks to know that Victor Young is a swell guy. This evening he treated me to an 8-course dinner. Yes, sir. Victor treated me to an 8-course dinner, a 7-piece layer cake, and a cup of coffee. Star number two, Miss Loretta Turnbull, the greatest female outboard motor racer of the world. And here's a cute thing. I've got a dog I call Outboard Motor. And just know why? Because last week, my dog gave birth to a litter of 18 pups. And that's why I call her Outboard Murder. Because with her, it's just a case of pup, 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 pup. Star number three, Willie Howard, one of Broadway's leading comedians. And what a daffy comedian he is. Just to show you how daffy Willie is, tonight he came to Shell Chateau wearing a black shoe and a brown shoe. And I said, Willie, what's the idea? Don't you know that your shoes don't match? And he said, isn't that funny? My brother had the same trouble. Star number four, Miss Irene Taylor, a Paul Whiteman discovery and a grand singer of songs. Miss Taylor always dresses in the latest fashion, too. Tonight, she told me something that surprised me. She told me that bustles are coming back in style again. Well, for the benefit of you men who don't know what a bustle is a dress with a rumble seat. Star number five, Henry Hull, star of that great drama, Tobacco Road. I was one of the men who expected Tobacco Road to win this year's Pulitzer Prize. You know, of course, that the Pulitzer Prize is an award that is given to what is considered the greatest American play of the year. Well, they gave the prize to a show called The Old Maid. And speaking of old maids, Henry Hull and I went to a masquerade party the other night, and we saw the cutest thing. We saw an old maid. Well, of course, there's nothing so cute about an old maid. But this old maid was made up as a postage stamp. She figured some mail would get stuck on her. Oh, got it. Well, you know how hot it's been all over the country the last few days. During these hot days, people naturally think of the seashore. You know, there are more people in the Borough of Manhattan than any other place its size in the world. And where do they go for a holiday? Coney Island. Victor, let's go to Coney Island together. Come on. Every summer, we go down to Deauville by the sea, where one can rub his shoulders with a king. St. Moritz in wintertime, oh, that's the place to be. And then to Paris in the spring, where one can have his little fling. Though Normandy is lovely in November, somehow it leaves you nothing to remember. I can't forget the night I met you down at Coney Island. Gee, I was proud you picked me from the crowd at Coney Island. And very soon I proved to you that my intentions weren't phony. It ended in matrimony. And now we're eating caviar.
Just as the melody lingers on long after the song has been played, so it is with the kind of personal banking you get at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. You appreciate all the things being done for you. It may not be noticeably apparent at first, but it grows on you. Modern personal banking services and more. The extra friendliness of the staff, not just the tellers, but the whole Farmers and Mechanics staff, branch managers, loan officers, even the president who is right there on the first floor with his door always open. Good old-fashioned service is a little rare in today's modern computer age, but you'll really find it at Farmers and Mechanics. And if you need computer age service at 2 o'clock in the morning, on a Sunday afternoon, or even on a holiday, you get it at Farmers and Mechanics 24-hour teller at four offices, Cromwell Square, Main and College Streets, and in Colchester and Montville. Join the happy customers of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank, where the feeling of real friendliness lingers on. Once again, your host for the Golden Age of Radio, Dick Bertel.
And our guest tonight is Carol Carroll, author of the new book, None of Your Business or My Life with J. Walter Thompson, Confessions of a Renegade Radio Writer, who wrote for such people as Burns and Allen, Eddie Cantor, Al Jolson, Victor Borge, Bert Lahr, W.C. Fields, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, Bob Hope, Bob Bazooka Burns, and so many, many more.
Well, name I think perhaps one more.
All right. How about so John Barrymore and Alan Nazimova? You didn't know I could come up with that, did you? Why don't we turn to the Kraft Music Hall, a great show with Bing Crosby.
Well, that's the thing that gave me whatever little, I hate to say fame and I hate to say notoriety, that I got, but that was a show that I did. I wrote for Bing for 10 years. People really loved to go on it because Bing handled them so well, and it was written for the guest. The guest got what he wanted. He was a king on it. Whenever anything was cut, it was a song or something. It was not the guest. And he had a say-so on what he wanted to say and what he didn't want to say. And it was more or less based on, it was a little bit like the night talk shows now. I would talk with these people, and sometimes I did all the talking, and they did nothing but nod. But I could tell by what they nodded at, what they were interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd see maybe three or four people on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And on Monday morning, I sat down, put a piece of paper and typewriter, and said, Kraft Music Hall, January 1st, 1937. And wrote it right from top to bottom, just as if I were writing a newspaper piece or something. And then this whole thing would be sent to Bing, and the parts of it that involved the guests would be sent to each of the guests. Then the next day, this was Tuesday, this was sent on Wednesday, I'd talk to each of the guests, and if they had any suggestions, these would be incorporated. Thursday, a boy picked up Bing's script and brought it to me, and I put together all the various little changes that might be. Somebody didn't want to say something, somebody couldn't pronounce such and such a word. And from this came the Crosby script, which everybody thought was ad-libbed. And sometimes it was. Sometimes we'd give a guest a line that Bing didn't think he had.
Mm-hmm.
This would force him to say something unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes Bing would say something to one of the guests that he didn't know was coming at him. And in this way, we got this little looseness.
Well, you actually created then the Crosby image in a way, because he was primarily a singer, and then he emerged as really a personality.
Well,
that,
this is true. He didn't want to talk when we started, when we moved the Kraft Show West. Bing said, well, get somebody to talk and tell the jokes, and then every once in a while say, here's Crosby to sing, and I'll sing. And we knew that this wouldn't work from experience, because we had had experience with Rudy Valli and with Al Jolson, and we just did the same show in a different way with Bing Crosby. If it works once, it'll work again. It'll work three times.
This is Ken Carpenter welcoming you to the Bing Crosby Show with John Scott Trotter and his orchestra, the Rhythm Ayers, and Bing's guest of the week, Miss Peggy Lee and Mr. Fred Allen. And now, this being Boy Scout Week, it gives me great pleasure to present a former boy who is still a good scout, Bing Crosby.
Say, you're right. You're right, Jeff. This is the 40th anniversary of the Boy Scouts.
Yes, sir.
Ken, the Boy Scouts is truly a wonderful organization. As a matter of fact, I really thought of it, but I didn't think I should. I was going to wear my old scout uniform tonight.
Yes?
But it's got a little tighter right around the merit badge. Binds me a little.
A little snug around the canteen.
Now you'll tell you what. Well, folks, we kind of feel like we certainly hit the jackpot in our guest department tonight, because our distinguished visitor is a former top-ranking radio star. I say former because he's been in retirement. He's been enjoying a hiatus from his career. However, we were able to interrupt his respite from radio and coax him out of the luxury of hibernation. And we're proud to welcome Fred Allen.
Well, thank you, Bing.
Bing, pardon me, what is that introduction? Retirement, hiatus, respite, hibernation.
Pretty classy?
Well, yes, it is, offhand. That's what a college education does for you. It takes you 20 minutes to call a guy a bum. I must say, it was nice of you to give this apprentice derelict, this neophyte in the welfare state, a touch of respectability, Bing.
Well, I didn't do it exactly for you, Fred. I was really thinking of the program. You see, we feel obligated here to maintain a certain amount of dignity. You know, class.
Class?
Mm-hmm.
On this program?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bing, for your information, I have seen more class hanging on B.O. Plenty's clothesline. Bing, any man who goes around dressed the way you do should never mention class. You're the only man I know who has baggy buttonholes. Look, I am out of work, and you look it.
Oh, now, wait a minute. Steady, Freddie. You're getting more crotchety than Barry Fitzgerald with me. If you're so touchy about being unemployed, why'd you quit radio?
Well, it was the pressure, Bing, the strain. Mm-hmm. The circles under my eyes were so deep, I looked as though my nose was riding a bicycle. For a while there, I was bouncing so many pills down my throat, my tonsils were black and blue.
Well, all I can say is it must have done you some good, because you seem to be in good shape.
Oh, I am. I am in good shape. I must admit that, Bing, and I owe it all to those new miracle drugs.
Oh, yeah?
They're wonderful. They have one cure for which there's no disease.
Your gay approach to such a lugubrious subject indicates that you're feeling better.
Yes,
you're back
I
on
am.
The way to recovery, and I know those of us in radio, you know, we felt kind of bad seeing your whole show go off the air.
Well, I tried to go off a little at a time, but they couldn't. I hated to break my show up, Bing, but the cast and my writers were all talented people, mm-hmm. and had no trouble, of course, getting other jobs.
I didn't think so, no.
However, it was quite a blow to the three can't men on my show.
Fred, what do you mean, can't men?
Well, you know those stuffed non-entities in radio who say you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't. They were really left stranded when the show went off the air.
Oh, they were sort of caught with their cats down.
Bing Crosby, how can you be so selfish?
What have I done?
Well, I was going to say that.
Oh,
What do you want? You have a beautiful voice, a wife, and four wonderful children, one of them working sporadically. And all I have is a couple of small jokes and very few places to tell it. Gosh, that line was my big chance. I was building up to it. And you step in with a zinger before I had a chance.
Well, you were caught with your chance.
That's a delightful sound. We'll be back to our guest, Carol Carroll, right after this.
When is a bank a savings bank? The answer to that question is when the word savings is part of the name, like Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank in Middletown, Cromwell, Colchester, and Montville. Now, there is a venerable century-old savings bank that features savings as their principal service to you, helping you to save frequently, helping you to save successfully. Any kind of savings account that suits your way of saving is yours. Theirs is a total effort, everything from an instant savings account, which you can open with only $5, to a six-month money market certificate that pays the highest rate and yield, $10,000 minimum, and the rate changes every week. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has such a variety of savings accounts and certificates that you can safely assume they have your kind of a savings account. And assume something else, that the interest rates paid on your savings are the highest permitted by law. Saturday hours at 6 branch offices and 24-hour teller service at the Cromwell Square office, Main and College Street, Middletown, Colchester and Montville offices. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio. This is Dick Bertel.
And this is Ed Corcoran.
Shall
this
we go back to the...
shall
we
go...
I want to get in there someplace.
Shall we go back to the Kraft Music Hall?
One of the excerpts I have that I'm very fond of is one that you did write with Eddie Bracken. You even remember the exact...
Well, Eddie Bracken was very fond of it. We did it once, and then he called me up and said, can I come on the show and do it again sometime? And this was a parody on the old British Army thing, you know, where the general's son was the weakling who crumbled under fire. And we did this whole parody, only the kid was an elevator operator, and he was breaking up under the strain of running the elevator up and down and up and down.
I can't stand it. I can't stand it. I tell you, it's not human. Up and down, up and down. Call me quitter if you want to. Call me deserter. Do what you want to me, but I'm through. Do you hear? I'm quitting the service.
Gad, lad, pull yourself together here. Think what you're saying.
I'm quitting the service, I tell you. Quitting, quitting, quitting.
You've been drinking.
No, I haven't been drinking. I've been thinking.
That's also forbidden in the service. An elevator operator is not expected to think.
That's why I don't want to be an elevator operator.
You don't... Now, pull yourself together, lad, and be glad that nobody heard you here. When you've been in the service longer and grown to understand it better, you love it.
I know all there is to know about the service. I'm not the first in my family to run an elevator.
No, and if you can remember your directions, you shan't be the last. Just think, someday you might even get to be a starter like me.
I don't want to be a starter like you. Instead of going up and down, you stay on the main floor and play with your castanets.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Sit down, lad. Sit down here tomorrow and think what you're saying. How can you hate the service?
Oh, no, sir. I don't hate the service. Sometimes it makes me feel very high. And other times, as today, I feel very low.
Every elevator operator has his ups and downs.
That's the trouble, sir. Just up and down. Up and down! Sometimes I feel as though I'm in a rut. I joined the service to see action.
And you are seeing action, my boy.
Captain Crosby, do you think I'll ever be able to run my elevator sideways?
The funny thing about people used to like to get on that show because every guest got a great big hamper of all the Kraft products, all the cheeses and all the caramels and a beautiful wooden cheese tray and something. And at that time, Davy Niven was under contract to Sam Goldwyn that gave Mr. Goldwyn 50% of any money that Niven's made outside of the studio. He got so much a week from the Goldwyn people, and if he picked up another $500, he wasn't worth a lot then, from doing the Kraft show, Mr. Goldwyn was entitled to $250. So besides the $250 that he sent to Mr. Goldwyn, he took every item in this basket of Kraft goods, including the basket, and sawed it in half. And Mr. Goldwyn got a half a tray and a half of a bunch of jars of cheese and a half of... He took each caramel in a bag of caramel and chopped each caramel in half. He was so mad about this.
Well, Carol, and I'm calling you by your first name, not
right.
Mr. Carol. Did you ever get involved with rebroadcasts? What I mean by that, of course, the shows that were redone for the West Coast or the East Coast, as the case may be. Perhaps we should explain for our audience.
There was recording was a dirty word to the networks because subconsciously they didn't realize this themselves. They knew if they could allow recordings on, there was no reason to have a network, any kind of recording. So they would not let any record be played. I wanted to play a record of Caruso in a semi-dramatic sketch that I'd written that required people to be listening to Caruso, and they wouldn't let it play it. I had to cut the scene because I couldn't find anybody who could sing like Caruso. But Shell Chateau, for instance, instead of being rebroadcast for the West Coast 3 hours later, for instance, we used to do it at 9 o'clock and then do it again at 12. We didn't do it again at 12 on Saturday night. We did it again at 12 on Monday night, which required getting that whole cast and everybody back together, 48 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in this particular time, we had a fellow by the name of Jack Barrymore, one of the greatest actors that ever lived, and a pretty heavy man with a tankard.
In other words, he drank a lot.
He drank quite a lot, and he enjoyed every minute of it. In fact, he was so brilliant when he was sloshed that you hated to see him sober up. And we finally got him to rehearsal. And when the show came to be done, he was doing a scene from The Jest, which he had done on the Broadway stage with his brother Lionel. And he stumbled across the stage over some cables through the orchestra, muttering some beautiful words that are now said only on campus. And fortunately, they were not heard very clearly. And he came to the microphone and started to read. His hand trembled so that you wouldn't believe that he could read the printed page. And the two people who were working with him in it had to follow him very closely because twice he took two pages off at the same time. Nobody noticed. He grunted a lot. He was about the color of your tie. And it got to such a point that I was sure he was going to die. Mm. Not lay an egg, but fall down, die. I couldn't watch him. I was in the control room. I laid down on the floor. It was just too terrible. And when it was all over, the sponsor called up, said that's the greatest dramatic performance Barrymore ever gave because all those grunts and noises came over his passion.
Yeah.
Well, I thought maybe we might move on to another very exciting part of your career, Mr. Carroll. We're going
to
keep.
I'm glad it's exciting to you.
And that would be with the very famous Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. I know you did a great deal of work.
The most exciting part of my career was when I was 8 years old and went to a fire in a fire.
It's
I
all
don't
want to
tell you about that. Everything is down here. With Ed Bergen, I did a lot with Ed Bergen and Bill Fields, who was another character who had a heavy elbow. And Bergen, of course, is a most remarkable man who managed to sublimate his inner animosities through a little piece of wood named Charlie McCarthy. He is a quiet, not very funny man. When he uses Charlie McCarthy, he is a very funny man. Of course, as you know, Bergen is the only ventriloquist in the world who moved his lips more than the dummy. And this he knows and everybody knows, and it's one of the reasons he was such a great success on radio. He was a big success in very classy nightclubs like the Rainbow Room and things because his jokes, his wit was so great. They didn't care whether he was a good ventriloquist or not.
The light was also bad.
And then. The light was bad, and they were a little drunk.
Well, is it true, then, that Charlie was Edgar's alter ego?
I don't know whether he was his alter ego, but he was a fella Edgar would very much like to have been.
Yeah.
Because he said things to girls and to people and off the cuff that Edgar just wouldn't think of saying. It's just as if there were two people. I mentioned that we had a little chair made so that the Charlie McCarthy could sit sort of next to the mic, but a little in front of it so that the audience at the broadcast could see him. And Edgar was behind one of these big mics, largely to hide his lip movement and also to pick him up easily. And every once in a while, maybe every 2 weeks or so, the engineer on the show, will somebody please get Charlie on? Oh.
Why don't we bring back some pleasant memories, Ed, with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy.
Hello, everybody. Well, what excuse have you got for being so late? Well, I tell you, this time I'm so pooped I can't invent one. Oh, I... you see, Bergen, I... you're making my pants too long. I'm so glad to see all of you wonderful people. You know, I could just kiss every one of you. Well, now that's a nice thought, Charlie. Yes, it is. All single girls line up in the aisle. Yes, I can't say anything bad about anybody. I love everybody. I could kiss every single person on the show.
I say, hello, you chap.
All single girls back in the aisle again.
Charlie, now, please.
I forgot myself.
Ray, you're seeing the good side of Charlie.
Really?
Yes.
Yes, there is one, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's not always bad. You see, Charlie has a split personality. One who vacillates from positive to a disparaging attitude surreptitiously.
Down, boy, down. Now, unscrew that and give it to me in sections.
Well, it's very simple. Perhaps I can explain. Yes, I can explain by telling you a story.
Yeah?
Yes.
I will. Oh, we are in luck, aren't we?
All right. Yes, this is the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Now, Dr. Jekyll lived several centuries ago.
Your personal physician?
No. One night, Dr. Jekyll mixed a strange brew of powerful chemicals. And when Dr. Jekyll drank this mysterious potion, he became the monstrous Mr. Hyde. He forgot his lovely sweetheart and chased every girl he saw.
Gad! I wonder if I'm taking that stuff and don't know it.
All right. One day, while under the influence of this drug, an old man walked up to him and merely said, hello. And Mr. Hyde beat him to death.
Well, that ought to teach him not to speak to strangers.
Of course, killing this man made Mr. Hyde a murderer.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it'll do it every time.
Now, one time, the terrible Mr. Hyde stalked into a house where a beautiful girl lived all alone.
Yeah? What's the address?
No, please. The girl suspected he meant to murder her. He walked toward her, his long, hairy arms outstretched, his fingers groping for her throat.
Now, Bergen, save the gestures for television. And then think of something to save television.
There, she said, I've got you, and I'm going to kill you. And she said, no, no, don't kill me. I'm going to kill you. Please don't.
Isn't it wonderful? Wonderful how you can change your voice.
Thank you.
I swear it was two people.
All right. The poor girl kept pleading, don't kill me. Don't kill me. Don't kill me.
I'll go on, kill her.
Well, now, why do you say that?
Well, if she can't act any better than that, she deserves to die.
All right, all right.
Our guest tonight, Carol Carroll, here on the Golden Age of Radio, author of the new book, None of Your Business or My Life with J. Walter Thompson, The Confessions of a Renegade Radio Writer. What is your definition of the Golden Age of Radio, Carol?
Well, that was the time when the entire nation devoted its complete attention to listening to a dummy, a drunken juggler, and a singer who went boo-boo-boo-boo. I don't understand it at all.
Let's talk about W.C. Fields, who appeared for many, many years, I guess, as a regular on the Chase and Sanborn Hour with Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, didn't he?
Yeah, he was as long as the nerves of the network could stand him being on there, because nobody in the world knew what he was going to say.
Yeah.
I didn't write the material that he did. A guy by the name of Dick Mack did it. I was a supervisor on the thing. And he would rehearse pretty much what was on the paper. But when he got on the air, by this time he had had a lot of pineapple juice. And he didn't care what he said. Although he never said anything.
I was going to say,
really,
he never violated...
Never violated any taste. Actual good taste. He never swore. He never was blasphemous, and yet he used to do things that drove NBC wild. He had a whole routine on how he hated doctors. He said they looked down his throat, and the next thing you know, it would be clang, 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 and he was off to the hospital. Well, this was such a terrible routine about doctors that NBC said you can never say anything about doctors again, and so in He said the next time he wanted to mention the doctor, he simply said clang, clang, clang. So they said, now you can't say clang, clang. Well, it got so that every opportunity that he had, he said clang, clang, clang. And they couldn't cut him off all the time because it wouldn't have made sense. So he kept bugging him with this thing.
Clang, clang, clang.
Pull yourself together.
What is this sound I hear?
Bill, Bill.
Suffering from swollen thighs. Sitting down too much, I suppose. They made a mistake and bought me camphor balls instead.
Did you swallow them?
Yeah, and every time I sneeze, dozens of moths fly out.
What?
Yeah, a covey of moths closely followed by a bevy of silverfish.
A bevy?
Flying in V formation. Light fly on the wing.
Hey, Bill.
Here's a sign of
Bill, now look, wait a minute.
When the little
Bill,
children...
Bill, now look, hold it, now hold everything. Please, Bill, let's cut out the poetry. Nobody wants to hear anything about moths.
Moth in the flame?
No.
Don't you remember Maeterlinck's poem about the moth?
Oh, now, Bill, Maeterlinck wrote about bluebirds.
Practically the same thing.
Yeah, I guess it is. Anyway, you shouldn't sleep with your mouth open.
I don't. I sleep with my mouth closed. They crawl in through the nostrils.
Well, that gives them more room. Do you do anything about it?
Yeah, I usually drink a couple of glasses of Flip before retiring.
And does that kill the moth?
Doesn't help them any. I'm usually awake all night. There's one consolation, though. The moths suffer as much as I do. I feel them flying around in my stomach, screaming with pain.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Fields.
Oh, hello, Werner. Where's your Augusta?
That's Edgar Bergen.
Oh, yes, yes, I know. Don't tell me. Hello, Edwin.
Edgar.
Don't prompt me. I know.
Mr. Fields, Charlie wants to say something to you.
Yes. Oh. Hello, Mr. Fields.
Hello, blood poison.
And now, do you feel sorry that you said I was full of termites?
I guess I do. I guess I do. I really haven't had time to give it much thought.
You know, Charlie really loved you, Mr. Fields.
Yes, I do. But I don't think Mr. Fields loves me.
Now, listen, that's gone far enough. I've been a gentleman up to now.
Why, what's the matter, Bill?
Well, he's not going to tell me I don't love him. I'll break every knot in his body.
Carol, Carol, let's talk about your book, None of Your Business or My Life with J. Walter Thompson. This book differs from other books of the era of radio broadcasting in that you are recounting your own personal experiences.
Yeah, well, this isn't just something that I looked up or something that I interviewed people and got some information about. This is the bitter, terrible thing that happened.
You managed to survive.
The fun I had with them. But it's full of things that, in greater detail than I've talked to them about them here, and a lot of things about things I did that nobody knows about. Things with Frank Sinatra, with Ed Gardner. You remember Ed Archie Gardner?
I sure do. Yes.
Wonderful, crazy man.
Well, Carol, Carol, I've enjoyed, personally, sharing these wonderful stories with you, and our audience can share these same experiences by reading your book, None of Your Business, or My Life with J. Walter Thompson.
For $3 more, I'll come over and read it to him with an accent.
Thanks so much for being our guest here on the Golden Age of Radio.
It was great.
Not for a while, let a song be your style, use this shampoo. Don't despair, use your head, save your hair, use this shampoo.
The Golden Age of Radio was brought to you by Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Farmers and Mechanics, serving you for over a century. 7 offices in Middletown, Cromwell, Colchester, and Montville. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Dick Martell.
Family.
The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.